Hey, fight fans. Next up on This Week in Law, we've got 50 Shades of Unauthorized Viewing of Mayweather Pacquiao. Title's all wet. Popcorn time is scorched. And the Empire would have won if they'd just had big data. All that and more with me, Sarah Pearson, Evan Brown, and Bill Hankis next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 301, recorded May 1st, 2015. Hollow towels, 300 each. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution that can help your law firm and any small business save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWiL. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Pro Flowers. Mother's Day is May 10th, and Pro Flowers has got you covered. Get one dozen rainbow roses in a free glass vase for just $19.99 plus shipping. Visit proflowers.com, click the microphone in the top right corner, and enter the code TWIT. Let's get ready to rumble! We're starting This Week in Law, and in case you hadn't noticed, there's a fight going on this weekend. We're going to talk about that in just a bit here. But first, I want to introduce you to the great group of folks who is joining me today to do the show. And welcome back to the show after a much too long hiatus, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Denise, it's wonderful to be back. Wonderful to see you again. And great to be interacting with the folks in IRC and the people who are listening and watching. Really looking forward to this conversation. It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's so good to have you back. And joining us again is Sarah Pearson, my co-host. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Denise. Happy to be here.
Great to see you, Sarah. Everything going well this week?
It is. Just getting back from vacation. So it's been a little bit crazy, but I'm excited to be back.
Good, good. And I'm also excited to welcome to the show Bill Hankis. Am I saying your name right, Bill? Is it Hankis? Hankis?
Hankis.
Hankis. There we go. Didn't even guess that one, so I'm glad I checked. Bill Hankis, who is the founder and CEO of Scoop, S-Q-O-O-P, which is an information gathering and sort of inspirational site for journalists as they're looking for newsworthy things to cover. It's a startup based in Seattle, and we actually featured it a few episodes ago. I think it was on episode 297 as one of our resources of the week, and Bill and I were communicating about that, and I thought he'd be super interesting to have on the show. So here he is. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
Thanks so much, Denise. Appreciate the invitation. I hope that I will be somewhat interesting at least.
Oh, I know you will. We're going to dive into the fight of the century that is coming up tomorrow in Las Vegas. And of course, as everyone has been so obsessed with whether Pacquiao or Mayweather is going to prevail in this fight, really what I've been obsessed with in the last couple of days is how the heck HBO and Showtime and all the other rights holders involved are dealing with things like Meerkat and Periscope. So I thought we'd start out talking about the fight. First of all, I should question my premise here a bit because I live with a sports fan who has had sort of nonstop fight pre-coverage on for the last couple of weeks. But I'm wondering if that's just, you know, my own little bubble. It does seem to be a lot in the news, but does anyone on the paddle with me even know what I'm talking about? There's this fight going on tomorrow. Evan, are you following this?
I know what you're talking about, but it sort of reminds me of what happens every 4 years with World Cup, maybe every 4 years with the Winter Olympics. It's like, oh, yeah, I follow this all the time. Sure, I know everything there is about boxing. And I knew that it was a big deal for there to be a matchup between Mayweather and Pacquiao. So, sure, of course, I knew about it. No, realistically, it's one of those things that when there's a big event coming on, you sort of get it by osmosis unless you're an enthusiast. So I knew it was going on and, of course, studied up a little bit more when we'll be talking about these legal issues that go around at it. But I think it's probably a little more intense in your household than it is the average right. household around the country. I don't know. Sarah, do you have a different perspective?
No, I was going to say, I don't know if I live under a rock, but I didn't even know about the fight. I had known nothing about boxing. I'm more honest. Not on my radar at all until these copyright issues came up, which are really interesting. But
yeah, see, so I'm actually kind of glad that I get exposed to the sports world because it does have some very interesting business and copyright considerations that come up. Bill, are you going to subscribe pay-per-view or anything, or could you care less?
I'm sharing tenancy under the rock with Sarah.
Here we go. Okay, nice. So let's talk about the numbers for the fight a little bit and why it actually is a big deal how people are going to consume it. First of all, I mentioned the pay-per-view. That costs basically $100, $99.99, if you're going to fork over and watch the pay-per-view at home. There are various other legal ways you can consume this production that will happen tomorrow. One of them is by being there in person. And the tickets are just, you know, the coverage on that has been really interesting to watch. I understand the prices are starting to drop a little bit down out of the stratosphere as we speak. ESPN had a story up this morning that the ticket prices were falling a bit. But if they stay on track with what they've been doing this week, this stands to be the priciest ticket to any sporting event on average ever, lapping the World Cup. Evan, which was previously the World Cup finals last year, were previously the most expensive sporting event of all time. There are only 16,800 tickets available for the fight. Only 500 of those tickets went on sale to the general public. 500 out of the 16,800. The rest of them were all sold to ticket brokers or goodness knows how they divvy up the rest of the tickets. I'm sure MGM has quite a few that it decides who of its big hitters get to have them. The ticket prices, if you're buying them not from MGM, if you're buying them in the aftermarket, have been really, really through the roof. $1,500 is the face value of the least expensive ticket. $10,000 face value of the ringside tickets. And then if you're looking on StubHub for things, SeatGeek is another big one for getting tickets. Over $3,000 for the least expensive tickets that have been on sale this week. And some of them have just been absolutely crazy. $351,000 asking price for a ringside ticket on StubHub on Thursday afternoon. So really quite the difficult time to get there. So you can imagine that if someone has managed to land themselves in one of those seats, that's a pretty plum place to be. They're probably not the first thing occurring to them is to hold up their phone and Periscope the fight. But who knows? You know, maybe there are people whose tickets have been purchased for the sole purpose of enabling them to do that. At any rate, the promoters of the fight have been very proactive. The very definition of proactive, actually, this week, Torrent Freak has a couple of great stories picking out that there was a Filipino IT professor who has actually been arrested because he is suspected of being someone who streams events like this, must have made some kind of indication that he planned to stream this particular fight, he is alleged to have operated a site called Pinoy-TV-Replay.com. They actually managed to get him arrested on the anticipation that he might stream this fight. Similarly, there's a lawsuit pending. Similarly, and perhaps a bit more traditionally, there's a lawsuit pending seeking injunctive relief that seems to have been effective in putting a stop to two other sites who had advertised that they were going to make live streams of the fight available. And now I'm not quite sure how they planned to do that. Again, not being a huge sports consumer myself, but I did thumb through the complaint against these sites a bit. Both of the sites are down now, the complaint at least, without even having gotten any injunctive relief at this point from the court, I think. The complaint at least, you know, was sufficient to dissuade them from even having the sites up. But the complaint mentions not just stopping those site owners from streaming the site, but from aggregating streams of other people who might be streaming the site. So I found that interesting that, you know, not only are we in the realm of sort of pre-crime here in both instances, the arrest and the lawsuit, but pre-crime via linking. So we're getting even one step removed from direct infringement. And there's a really good piece at Bloomberg talking about various other piracy considerations about the fight. And they call it whack-a-mole, you know, that as soon as the fight goes live, there are going to be a flurry of takedown notices to people who are hosting live streams or making those available online, because there is no authorized legal online way to watch the fight. You either have to be in one of those very expensive seats, pay the pay-per-view price, or if you're at the MGM Grand, they have 50,000 closed circuit tickets available. So for $150, if you're there at the hotel, you can, I'm not sure if you can watch in your room or you have to go to some central area, but you're not actually in the ring or, you know, around the ring. You are somewhere else in the hotel watching on a TV to the tune of $150. So setting the table thusly, Evan, I'm wondering what you make of all this.
Well, isn't it interesting? Because you're bringing up the weirdness of it in terms of pre-crime. You know, like there's all this stuff going on before, you know, days, weeks before the fight even happens. And that's strange enough in and of itself, if we're just thinking of in the abstract, it being some unlawful or dangerous event that is being enjoined. But even if we step back another layer of a level of abstraction and think of how odd that is, we're talking about copyright infringement that hasn't happened yet. That's the whole premise for asserting that this is unlawful conduct. And when you stop and think about what copyright infringement normally is, it is the infringement of a work. And what is a work? A work is something that has been reduced to a tangible medium of expression, actually, you know, fixed in a tangible medium of expression. So we're getting these orders from the court about conduct that hasn't even happened yet, and then the unlawful conduct that will be occurring according to the allegations in the future is the fixation of this activity, this visual scene, in a tangible medium of expression. So there's that extra sort of element of oddity to it. And I think we have to do a little bit of mental gymnastics, and there's probably a little bit of mental gymnastics, legislative gymnastics that Congress went through in enacting that part of the Copyright Act that allows for the copyright protection in like live broadcast sporting events. You know, that notice you hear at the end of professional sports games. You especially hear it, you know, at the end of the NFL games, like this telecast is copyrighted 2015 by National Football League, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, wow, this thing just happened. It's being fixed in the tangible medium of expression right as we speak, but yet it's subject to copyright protection. So, you know, there's big business, there's big money, and it's sort of the natural consequence of the business model, because what the promoters are doing and what the venue is doing here is really creating this scarcity, the scarcity of the ability to watch the fight. And so that certainly does increase demand, and to the extent that that demand is increased, then the desire and the impulse for people to pirate the content or to stream it without authorization. I know from last week's show you're on another kick of not saying piracy, right? You know, to stream the
trying to.
to stream the content without authorization. So it's kind of funny how those dynamics play off of one another.
It is, and I think you're right to point out that there are interesting considerations when you're talking about live sporting events. That Game of Thrones, which we've been discussing for the past couple of shows, has longevity, and live sporting events do not. The real opportunity for people to make money off this fight tomorrow lasts for the limited duration of the fight. And sure, there will be people who want to watch it after the fact, but once they know who has won, some of the polish goes off that apple.
Not
the same at all. Sarah, what do you think about the preemptive steps that have been taken, and also what might happen during the actual broadcast?
Well, I think Evan raises a really interesting point I hadn't thought about, which is that the actual copyrighted work doesn't even exist yet. That's really interesting to think about. I think that there are a lot of reasons why this model of kind of going after, you know, infringement before it occurs, but why that won't scale to other domains. I mean, one is just this fact that in this particular context, the value is so time limited, like you just mentioned, Denise. Another is that that you know, this restraining order is, you know, a prior restraint on speech. In situations like this, where you're just streaming someone else's content, I suppose there's very little argument that there's any sort of First Amendment issue. But you can imagine that in lots of other copyright contexts, that would be an issue. So you wouldn't be able to get the meet the prior restraint hurdle. As far as what happens during the show, I mean, I imagine they're going to be sending crazy amount of takedown notices. I have no idea whether or not people will respond quickly enough that it will actually make a difference or not. But I'm sure that they've got an army of people ready to do that.
Right. I think this is a good opportunity to sort of continue the live streaming discussion we've been having on the last couple of the shows about, you know, talking in the context then about live streaming Game of Thrones as it's airing, pointing your phone at the TV and putting that out there for people who don't have the opportunity or wherewithal to subscribe and pay for it, or the desire to subscribe and pay for it. You know, I mean, there's always that discussion of the economics of infringement if you're making it available to someone. Are you really taking away that person as a customer, or would that person, you know, have never actually paid for it, but will watch it for free nonetheless? So moving away from that abstraction and into the arena at the fight tomorrow, I have a couple of ideas about whether the people there, you know, having... They're a very rarefied bunch there in that arena. But they're also a very, I'm guessing, tech-equipped bunch. And I'm really curious whether there will be announcements before the fight, you know, about, you know, please keep your phone away. Are they going to try and keep people from taking pictures or video of any kind? Because as soon as you are pointing your phone from your ringside seat, perhaps, at the ring in front of you, you could well be live streaming the whole fight, which is something that they very much don't want to happen. And I think there is something to be said for and a demand for having that kind of view of the fight, real time from a ringside seat. So there is sort of a marketing PR gloss to all this too, Bill, knowing that that is your forte, that, you know, not in this particular event has there been an authorized way for those people in those pricey seats to share what they're watching with those of us in the outside world. But what do you think going forward might happen?
Right, right. Well, I feel like we've seen this movie before where a new piece of technology has come in and disrupted an existing business model, which is what you pointed out earlier. This is, in some respect, is, well, in a large respect, is about the economics of monetizing this fight. And in particular, because Meerkat and Periscope are so new, in the short term, there's probably nothing that the organizers, the fight organizers, can do other than, you know, try to prevent the type of infringement you've been talking about. But long term, they're going to have to find a way to adjust their business models in the same way that professional, in the same way that Major League Baseball did, for example, back in the late 90s when the internet arose. There's a new opportunity there, and I believe that there's a new opportunity to monetize via some of these live streaming mechanisms like Meerkat and Periscope and, you know, in the future others. So I think they're going to have to abandon this or at least modify their existing business model.
Right. I think you're right, too. And there's a really good piece for folks who want to read more about all of this and dive deeper into the issues. You can see all our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/301. And there's a good piece called Round Two for Social Video in there that talks about, you know, how you might be consuming a fight like this in the year 2020. And the one point that piece makes that I thought was really interesting is, aside from sort of enlisting audience members as fellow promoters of the fight, at the end it discusses things like the Oculus Rift and HTC Valve and Sony's Project Morpheus, basically these immersive viewing experiences. Let me read you some of that because it's sort of gives you a better feel. The chance for fans to have ringside seats for the match cannot be underestimated. Hearing each creak of the ropes and ducking each bead of sweat shooting from the boxers towards the viewer's eyes in almost perfect digital definition. So, yeah, I think there would definitely be an opportunity for a more immersive fight experience. And they talk about, you know, the camera maybe on the trainer inside the ring or on one of the fighters, you know, taking a page from how surfers and base jumpers and things capture their experiences and share them with the world. Evan, any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that it's fascinating to think of what the future will hold, especially with these immersive technologies, you know, virtual reality, when we see the Oculus devices coming mainstream and people having them as much as they have other kinds of devices now. But I don't know that it'll change the distribution model all that differently. There will be change in the way that we consume it, but there will always be what I was talking about in my first set of comments. You know, there will always be that economic component to it that's built around this idea of the scarcity of the ability to watch the event. So it would only make sense to have new ways of watching it, but I bet you there will always be very tight controls over that so that the optimal economic benefit can be derived by the stakeholders that are involved here. That's what I would add to that.
Right. It's too bad they're not having this event back when more people were walking around with Google Glass attached to their face, because it'd be interesting to see what the fight staff would do about that if someone were to walk in with one. Or just how about a GoPro attached to their cap, you know, a little bit more obvious.
Right.
See what they do. So I don't know. I'm going to continue paying attention to this. I'll let you guys know next week if you're interested, if I see any stories of people being escorted out because of their obvious overt attempt to either record or stream. But in the future, those attempts aren't going to be obvious or overt, and people aren't really necessarily going to think about them, right? I mean, all these wearables that we're going to be, or people in general are going to be walking around with, whether it's on their body or their wrist or whatever, just capturing experiences. I don't know that a whole lot of thought would be given by the audience member to the fact that they were keeping a record of this thing that they had paid a bunch of money to attend. And I don't know how detectable that stuff will be in the future. So, Sarah, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I guess the only thing I was thinking after Evan's comment is I guess I'm not quite as confident that scarcity is always going to be the model. Maybe some form of scarcity, but I think you're seeing less and less of that just as it's becoming harder to control. People are trying to find other ways to make money. So if people do figure out another way to make money that doesn't involve having to, you know, kind of fight this distribution, I think that they would go for it. I don't know that there isn't that model. That model doesn't exist yet. At least there's no magic bullet, but I can imagine in the future that there might be something that doesn't involve scarcity.
All right. Well, I think we have a good opportunity to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We'll make that holographic sweat. We put these phrases into the show in case you are an attorney or another professional who listens to the show for professional or continuing legal education in your jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions like to have you verify that you've actually watched or listened. So we put these in as a service to those of you in those jurisdictions. Let's talk about some other entertainment-related stuff. We've all been watching. It's been about a month now since Tidal launched. Tidal appears to be all wet, though. Sarah, have you been following its plummet?
I have. Well, I mean, I saw that one story about how apparently subscription rates have been really, really low after the initial splash. They got a lot of publicity when they launched, in huge part, I think, because it involved Jay-Z and a number of other really famous artists. But it sounds like they have not gotten as many subscribers as they were hoping to. And I think this article even called it a spectacular flop. Yeah, I see the headline there.
They indeed. Yeah. And pointed out that while it briefly cracked the U.S. iPhone top 20 download chart, it then crashed out of the top 700. And here's the PR spin on this one, Bill. It appears to, and I didn't see a whole lot of these ads that were slamming Spotify, for example, but according to this coverage, there was some negative advertising by Tidal saying, saying how artists don't benefit as much from services like Spotify, et cetera. And what seems to have actually happened is there's a correlation. Now, always question when there's a correlation, you don't know that means causation, but there seems to be a correlation at least between Tidal's negative rhetoric and Spotify's download performance going up. Seems to have given some attention to the service that maybe it might not have had and reached some customers maybe it might not have reached. Any thoughts on that, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, this is the same narrative that Taylor Swift started when she was fighting with Spotify. And so this isn't a terrible surprise, nor is it a surprise that Tidal is tanking, despite Jay-Z's tweets to the contrary a couple of days ago. You might remember that I ran Communications for Real Networks, which included the Rhapsody digital music service. And we were really the first to market with a streaming music service. And we used to joke all the time about, you know, the latest flavor of the week to compete mm-hmm. in the area, and really the only one that has done reasonably well is Spotify. And you know, their numbers are moving in the right direction and have for a long time. They seem to, my daughter who's 15 listens to them instead of Rhapsody, much to my chagrin. But you know, they're getting that kind of traction. Now, all of that said, Tidal might even be a great idea, But digital music is a horrible, horrible business to be in. The labels are going to take a chunk of money. The artists get surprisingly little if you take a look at some of the royalty reports. And so what's left is very little for a business like Tidal or Rhapsody or, you know, previously Napster or Spotify to enjoy. So I'm not terribly surprised. It's a terrible business to be in.
Yeah, and Jay-Z has gone on Twitter saying, look, you know, you can't just judge us right out the gate. Give us some time. We're building an audience, etc. You know, not fair to say that we're a spectacular flop at this point. Evan, do you agree?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, about whether it's maybe too early in the game to predict the demise. Is that the part?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it certainly isn't a great start. And I don't know if there are any comparisons we can make to situations in the past where there's sort of been, you know, a few steps out of the starting gate. There's a stumble like this. It would be helpful to look to see if there are any stories like you could, you know, I would go research this by going through the archives of TechCrunch or something like that to see how companies have started in their first few weeks. I just think it's really interesting how, you know, it's the PR side of this that's more interesting than anything, because you've got these negative attacks on Pandora and Spotify, and that seemed to bring attention to them. And it's interesting to actually have seen those apps increase in popularity. And plus, I don't know if we brought it up already, sort of the negative side of having Beyonce and Nicki Minaj being the spokespeople. Did we talk about that already? How it's like hard to have a whole lot of sympathy that they're not getting paid enough as artists, and that Tidal would be a useful alternative to that. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, it probably is too soon to tell, but certainly isn't looking good. I would say it's going to be hard to recover.
You know, right. They're probably going to be their ringside or close to it at that fight tomorrow. So hard to have a whole lot of sympathy for
got it from their royalties, just you know, their 4 or 5 cents at a time, you know, that's how they got so wealthy, right? So
that's right. Sarah, any further thoughts on this?
No, I mean, I had to resist when I posted this link on Twitter. I had to resist saying I told you so, but I remember thinking I just don't really understand what the value proposition is for people to pay. So there, it seems to me like there are two things. There's one, you could pay because you think that artists, you know, you feel bad that artists aren't making enough money. In that case, that's when these really famous artists, you know, the association with these really famous artists, I think, hurts them. And then the other is hi-fi tracks, but I just don't know that market is very big. So I'm not at all surprised that that people aren't, you know, running to pay for music when they could get it many, many places for free.
Well, we're going to come back and talk a bit more copyright and entertainment-related stories in just a moment. But I'm going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. And I'm thrilled to tell you that all of our sponsors today are a great opportunity to help you out with a very big day coming up next Sunday, and that is Mother's Day. I hope that you're already thinking about Mother's Day and how you're going to take care of your mom. And I encourage you to bear our sponsors from this week's show in mind when you do it. And our first one is FreshBooks. Many mothers are business people and need a great way to keep track of their time, invoice their clients. And if your mom is not already familiar with FreshBooks, you need to let her know, because it's amazing how many lawyers and other business people I know who spend too much time practicing paperwork rather than practicing law or whatever else their business consists of. On top of their piles of affidavits, if you're a lawyer, and case files, there are billable hours that need tracking, expenses to manage for every business, and always client invoices that you have to prepare and get out. FreshBooks makes your life, and hopefully your mom's life too, a little bit easier. I use FreshBooks in my law practice. It works seamlessly and wonderfully for me. I really don't know how I would have the law practice I have today without FreshBooks. I'd have to hire staff, and that I don't have to do with FreshBooks because it really takes care of all of those details. I've never been great with math and accounting and keeping track of expenses and billing and stuff, But I don't have to be, because FreshBooks takes all the information and does the math perfectly appropriately, thank goodness, and also puts it into a very professional looking package that I can send out to clients and feel really good about. It's a super simple cloud accounting piece of software. It gives thousands of lawyers like me, and you too, if you're a lawyer, the tools that you need to save time billing and get paid faster. It lets you create and send super slick invoices online in minutes. And tracking your time has never been easier. You can use the mobile app to track your billable hours from anywhere. Plus, FreshBooks mobile apps help you organize receipts while you're running around between the office, a client meeting, the courthouse, wherever your practice or business takes you. If you do have questions, the award-winning FreshBooks support rock stars are waiting. There's a real-life person on the other end of the phone to help out. So if you are going to take my advice and help your mom out with her business accounting needs, it's totally simple and totally free for 30 days with no obligation. Let mom know she can go to freshbooks.com/twill. And please ask her not to forget to enter twill, T-W-I-L, in the How Did You Hear About Us section. She or you can start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right. Popcorn time is getting scorched in the UK. Popcorn time, you'll recall, is it's been called the Netflix for television. Netflix, not for television. What is popcorn? It's not
for pirates.
Netflix for piracy.
Thank you.
So you can't say that.
Netflix is for television. Thank you. Netflix for pirates. It just gives a very nice interface to being able to access torrents, a very nice user experience. And so what's gone on in the UK is there has been a judgment that has told the United Kingdom's five largest ISPs that they're required to restrict customers' access to sites offering downloads of Popcorn Time. So I guess they have an affirmative responsibility to comb the web and determine where those sites are. I'm sure some of them at least have been supplied in the course of the litigation. But, you know, talk about whack-a-mole, Evan. How is an ISP supposed to know everywhere where a piece of software might be available for download and then block them?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the troubling part of this. And you know, I admit I did not pick that up on that part of it. Whether the ISP has this affirmative obligation to go and look for this. I didn't pick that up from reading this article about it, but maybe that's there. And if so, that's the real problem here, because I don't think most reasonable people would disagree with the idea that if a service is found to be infringing, and like if we put it into the U.S. context, like a Grokster type of responsibility for secondary liability for infringement, I don't think, you know, the vast majority, the critical mass of reasonable people would disagree that there ought to be some legal remedy by the rights holders to stop that technology from being distributed. And so long as the intermediary who's responsible for that distribution is put on notice and has the ability to ascertain what is okay to be out there and what ought to be blocked, you know, that's perfectly sensible. But if the intermediary then is put in a position of being liable merely for having missed something and not taken enough steps to go out there and actively, proactively look for technology that is going to facilitate or contribute to, or whatever word you want to use, infringement, that's a little bit too much. And that's where I think the rights of the rights holders, the enforcement of the rights goes a little bit too far in the other direction. So I hope that that's not what's happening here, that there actually is an affirmative obligation on this ISP. If that's not what's happening here, then, you know, this seems nothing really too much different than what they did with the Pirate Bay. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that Popcorn Time here is, you know, a Grokster-like infringing device. Again, to use the vocabulary from Grokster. Does anybody disagree? Am I talking? Is what I'm perceiving as reasonable? Just am I out in left field somewhere? Correct me if I am.
No, I don't think so. Seems spot on to me. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I think the same. I was, when you prefaced with any reasonable person would agree, I was sitting here hoping that I was going to agree with you. But I do.
Yeah. It's dangerous to do that, you know.
Exactly.
But I don't, hey, Bill, yeah, I don't
this could it. Be this could be a dangerous or scary analogy I'm going to draw here, but bear with me for a moment, because we were talking before about sites that might be aggregating illegal live streams, unauthorized live streams of the fight. And now we're talking about Popcorn Time aggregating unauthorized torrents. And it makes me think a little bit that this holding people liable for aggregating and creating a nice interface and making it convenient to access things on the web might make you a little bit nervous, because that's what your company Scoop is all about. Granted, hopefully what you're going to be linking to is a different breed of stuff. But can you see where I'm going here, where hanging liability on someone for bringing stuff together and packaging it and making it nicely available when it isn't otherwise available could make you a little bit nervous?
Well, thankfully, it doesn't make me nervous in the case of Scoop, because what we're doing is aggregating publicly available information from the SEC, the Patent Office, and the federal court system. In fact, that's a sort of a nice jumping off point to talk about. In the case of the federal court system, which is anybody in any of your listeners who access PACER, which is Public Access to Court Automated Records, the PACER.gov website, understands that there's a paywall there, so that if you're interested in downloading a summary judgment from a case that you're looking at, that's going to cost you 10 cents a page. Now, what Scoop does, we allow people to search for that case, to search for that summary judgment in the example. But if you want to download the document, then we provide a link to PACER so that you can download that content using your site credentials, and PACER will charge you accordingly. So I think that Scoop is probably not in the same time zone as the Popcorn Time discussion.
It could be, though, if you started to include things like Scribd or other document repositories where that might contain public records and might contain other, you know, things that you have no control over, don't really know what's in there.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Denise, because part of our long-term plan is to move beyond the public documents phase and tackle sites like LinkedIn and Twitter and many others. And there are sites that contain competitive information that reporters would be interested in as well. So we will just have to forge, our approach there will be very different. We'll have to forge commercial agreements with companies like Twitter and LinkedIn to access their information, or strike an agreement with companies that already do that.
Right. Sarah, any final thoughts on Popcorn Time?
Nope, not for me.
All right. Well, since we started talking a bit about Bill's business and background, I thought it would be fun. You dropped in passing your involvement with Rhapsody, which obviously, and Real Networks, which has been sort of a big player in the development of internet law over the years. So maybe just take us down memory lane a little bit, Bill, and tell us about your experiences there.
At Real Networks, I was head of communications there. And for those people not familiar with Real, we had three primary businesses. There's the music business, which was Rhapsody, the games business, Gamehouse, and the legacy, maybe I shouldn't call it legacy, but the Real Player business, which is the piece of software, really, that gave the internet a voice back in 1994-95 timeframe. And so you're right. We faced many, many battles, contention around being a rights holder, but also working with rights holders in the case of musicians or game developers or Hollywood in the case of movie content. So we had to deal with issues across the board and all of those things. And although I'm not a lawyer, I'm a communications guy, I ended up working very closely with lawyers and forming, you know, public responses to some of the things we did, because they tended to get a lot of attention.
Is it kind of interesting and maybe a little strange for you that the Real DVD case, which was kind of a big deal, and Real Networks sued preemptively to try and protect their software that enabled people to rip and store their DVDs, and this was a big no-no as far as the DVD Copy Control Association was concerned. I remember when Real Networks filed preemptively to try and say what we're doing here should be legal and fine, and we're not facilitating infringement here, so back off, basically.
Right.
Is it weird now to look back and see that technology, I don't know, I mean, DVDs are still there and people still do like to, if they have them, use them more flexibly than just in their Blu-ray player. But still, this issue seems to have fallen by the wayside with the availability more broadly now of streaming technologies.
A little bit, that's right. Keep in mind, though, people have been ripping DVDs since, I don't know, 10 minutes after the DVD Copy Control Association created its encryption technology called CSS, which is, actually, I can't remember what it is anymore. But that CSS was hacked like 10 minutes after it was released. And so people were ripping DVDs with such frequency that PC World began to publish an annual list of the best DVD rippers. And this is before Real DVD came on the market.
So right.
The irony of the Real DVD case was that this was intended to be a legal means by which people could make a fair use copy of the DVDs they purchased and play them back later. And the funniest part about it is that Real Networks is a licensee to the DVD CCA, so the Copy Control Association. So we had a license to decrypt the disc. Now, Judge Patel later ruled that although it might be okay for people to make a copy of their DVD in certain cases, it was illegal to be able to manufacture the means by which consumers would actually do that. But, I mean, the whole thing just seemed silly from a business perspective, that Hollywood was missing out on an opportunity to embrace something that was actually beneficial for them. It provided another means, it provided a legal means for people to do what they were already doing. In fact, PC Magazine complained when they reviewed Real DVD that with the added layer of encryption that Real DVD put on top of the DVD technology, that the DVD was locked down, quote unquote, tighter than Hannibal Lecter. And so I think Hollywood missed a business opportunity. And that's, par for the course for rights holders in many cases. The music industry did it. They've been suffering ever since.
Evan, do you think this is a non-issue now that there are DVD rippers out there that people can comfortably lay their hands on if they want to, because it's just not being pursued?
Well, there's a lot of content that's locked up there and mm-hmm. people have these in their archives. Any vector by which content can be made available and put in a way that it can be shared more easily, I think is going to be seen by the studios as a threat. So I guess what we look at is, in the reality, there may be less enforcement, but I don't think that that's a true indication that there is less of a threat to the studios and the other rights holders in this instance. It's just that the nature of the ordinary consumption has changed, more streaming rather than through physical media. But that doesn't mean that taking it off of the physical media and making it available isn't still a problem. So it's just more of a shift in everyday usage, I would think.
Yeah. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's more a matter of whether it's a good business decision for them to try to enforce when nobody really uses DVDs anymore. I can't think of the last time I used a DVD, and I watch stuff all the time. So it just seems like it might not be worth their time to go after it anymore.
You guys are making me feel old-fashioned. We watch DVDs all the time in my house.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, sure, we do too. I mean, it's big for us in the car. You know, the kids. We're a minivan family, and so you know, my 9-year-old and 7-year-old sons love watching DVDs, and it's just not, you know, there's Bluetooth technology in the van and all that stuff, but it's still not real mainstream, I don't think. At least when we went looking for minivans a couple months ago, you know, to still see that sort of streaming technology being mainstream for that type of entertainment. So yeah, we've got DVDs laying around everywhere. So there's still physical media is still there. I don't know what the market numbers are, but just based anecdotally, yeah, it's there. So I wouldn't feel too old, Bill.
Yeah, no, this is one of those future is here, just not evenly distributed things, because I can't remember the last time I played a DVD, and I can't remember even wanting to play one really in a long time, even when traveling and going to areas where there's no connectivity, you know, in that sort of extreme situation, I would download something in advance and take it with me, and then it would evaporate when I had watched it, you know, rent it via iTunes or Amazon or something, and then it just goes away when you're done. And even, you know, I'm not without the kid factor either, Evan, but it just tends to, well, I don't have screens in the car, you know, no minivan here. So the screens that he has to enjoy are the ones he's already holding. And so it's either streaming on that device or, has been downloaded without the help of a DVD. So I don't know. I could certainly see how having a large DVD, you know, maybe it originally came from DVD library, would be an advantageous thing for people. And that's what Real DVD was all about. Right, Bill?
Yep, that's right. I mean, the use case was, you know, use the kids in the minivan. Mm-hmm. Kids are hard on physical media. They get scratched. There's peanut butter and jelly on them. You know, whatever. They get lost. How many of your DVD cases, Evan, are empty, right? And
yes.
So why not? You went out and you spent good money to buy Dora the Explorer, right? And you know, why wouldn't you be able to back that up and take it with you and play it? It just seems like a wonderful business opportunity for somebody. Evidently not Real Networks, and evidently not Hollywood.
Yeah, right. True. I won't make any commentary about Dora the Explorer other than, oh, who would want to lose that? So, you know.
No, backpack, yeah. I mean, come back.
Isn't it just natural? We see this anytime there's innovation. This is, you know, a fundamental principle I'm talking about right here. Anytime there's innovation, anytime there's disruption, you know, it takes a while. And, you know, we see wonderful strides in the last, I think of 2003 really as the watershed year for this, when iTunes was released. You know, we've seen huge strides in the way that digital media is consumed and in the way it's purchased, and therefore the way that it plays a role in the marketplace. And so there's still that tension and that strain between innovation and the what is perceived as the maximum exploitation by the copyright holders and all this. So we'll get there. You know, it eventually will. Make sense, don't you think? I mean, you have a much better perspective than I do, Bill, on this, having come from, you know, your Real Networks experience, having seen what things were like pre iTunes, back when, you know, Real Player was the thing, and that strange file, what was it, .rmv or something. I have this whole archive of weirdly formatted stuff I would love to listen to, but I have no idea how to actually make that happen today. So.
The digital equivalent of the 8-track, right?
Maybe hipsters should start, you know, getting special machines with 32-bit processors.
I mean, you're right. We will get there. It's just the road can be so painful sometimes, and it almost makes the business decision to pursue a Real DVD like product. The business decision can be faulty just because you know you're going to have to plow such hard ground, and the chances of succeeding initially are very low. But eventually, somebody's going to, maybe it's not going to be with the physical media because it will phase out over time. But you know, the technology is always going to take hold if it matches matches the consumer's interests and economics.
Yep. All right, I have to put our second MCLE passphrase into the show while Dora is fresh in my mind. I'm going to make it Boots. That was Dora's cute little monkey, yeah. In case you've never
experienced
the wonderful
your son.
Show.
your son, the fact that you know this, because I doubt you were watching it on your own. So
Swiper was always my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Swiper the Fox. Well, Swiper the Fox could have a good segment on our show with all our infringement stories. All right. In a moment, we're going to discuss how the Empire could have won, could have struck back and struck back effectively. But we're going to do that after we thank our second mother-friendly sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Blue Apron. Of course, we all love to eat. Goodness knows I love to eat. Love to cook too, but don't always have the time to run around, get the right ingredients. You know what I really don't have the time to do is pour through cookbook after cookbook, trying to come up with inspiration for something with great flavors and an innovative touch that I can whip up for family and friends. So Blue Apron does all that for me, and I really love it. It's really hard to find a meal that doesn't compromise somewhere. You need it to be a good value. You want it to be quick to prepare. Of course, you want it to be healthy and delicious as well, and that's where Blue Apron comes in. It makes cooking delicious meals easy and fun, and it delivers fresh, ready-to-cook meals right to your door. And it just, all the great stuff you love about cooking, you get with Blue Apron, because you get all your fresh ingredients, you get a great recipe, the inspiration has been provided for you, and you can tweak that a bit. You can tell Blue Apron what you like as far as foods, certain things you can't eat, if you like to kind of fine tune, or you can let them completely surprise you with the wonderful menus that they put together. And each one of those menus involves putting meals on the table for less than $10 each. They send you the fresh ingredients, perfectly proportioned, pre-measured, with step-by-step recipe instructions, including beautifully printed pictures, making cooking healthy meals really easy and fun. If you're a chef, you're going to be able to whip through these meals just knowing, oh gosh, you know, thank goodness this has all been prepped for me. You know, it's basically like your sous chef in the kitchen. Everything arrives and everything that you need to get going is right there. You're hitting the ground running as a chef. If you are not a chef, you will be well on your way to becoming one after having made a few Blue Apron meals, which take you step by step through some pretty sophisticated kitchen techniques. It makes a perfect gift for Mother's Day with pre-planned meals, taking all the guesswork and stress out of cooking at home. You can choose the number of weeks you'd like to send to mom, and you'll be able to gift home-cooked meals to the hardworking mother in your life. Each balanced meal is 500 to 700 calories per serving, and so yummy you'd never realize that. Cooking takes half an hour or so, shipping is free, and the menus are always new. They won't send the same meal twice, so you're not going to get sick. You're not going to get into a rut with Blue Apron meals. Quite the contrary, because really these are meals that I would expect to find on the menu in a high-end, very eclectic restaurant, because they draw ingredients and sources from all over the world. They do a really great job of incorporating exotic ingredients in a very user-friendly way. Blue Apron's experts source only the best seasonal ingredients for incredible meals like sirloin tip steaks with new potato, asparagus, and radish hash, and harissa glazed heirloom carrot salad with date molasses and spinach almond couscous. So you can see what I'm talking about. They really bring in a lot of interest and flavor to the meals that you're cooking at home. You'll be blown away by the quality and the freshness. And so will mom. So definitely check out Blue Apron. It's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals absolutely free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right, two meals free. They could even be two meals for mom, just for going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. All right. How could the Empire have struck back with greater force than actually happened in the Star Wars universe? Well, it would have involved knowing a whole lot more about you and raises privacy concerns. Sarah, you linked to this, and I thought it was just a great article. So why don't you tee it up for us?
Sure. I knew that you would love it. It was an article by Daniel Solove, who is a professor who writes a lot about privacy. And it's a really cute tongue-in-cheek article about how if the Empire had access to big data, they would have won the war. They would have known where Luke Skywalker was from data analysis. If they would have had better data security, they would have responded effectively to the data breach that went on in the movie, and kind of goes through all the different scenarios. And it's really pretty funny piece. I definitely recommend checking it out. It's in the Delicious Notes, the rundown for the week. So.
Right. And as you read it, were you thinking, I mean, I'm sure this was the message that Daniel Solove wanted to convey, that really any empire, any entity could become an evil empire as if it had access to this kind of data and wanted to use it for ill rather than good, right?
Sure. Yes, definitely. I think on the evil side with the big data, and also just making the point that how important data security is for any empire or organization or institution. So,
right. So, Evan, what do you think? Shall all the Jedi close down their online accounts and make sure that they're operating a little bit more stealthily? Pull down the hood, as it were.
Yeah, that would help a lot. You know, this is a really interesting piece. It shows, you know, the, Daniel Solove, how creative he is and what a great mind he has for privacy. And, you know, I know some of these things happened in the episodes 1 through 3, some of these instances here. But it's also interesting to sort of go back and think of the mindset of what there would have been about data privacy in, what, 1976, 77? Is that when mm-hmm. Star Wars first came out? You know, the idea, I mean, sure, we knew about privacy and those things here, but, you know, as far as having high technology affect data security and, you know, just the whole idea of data being stored that way and subject to unauthorized access would have been much more of an obscure and therefore much more erudite concept to try to capture in the 70s and 80s than what it is now. Now it's in the public consciousness. Back then it would not have been so much. So I think it's interesting to look at sort of Star Wars as a creature from a different time, far, you know, long, long ago in the 1970s when this stuff came out. So it's interesting to see so that perspective. Like why it was Ben Kenobi? Why did Ben Kenobi choose the same name as Obi-Wan Kenobi? You know what? That's kind of silly. But you know, there you go.
Right. I want to say it was 1976 because I was visiting a friend in Texas that summer, and I think we went and saw episode 4 together. I just tried to look that up and managed to crash Chrome, so I'm reopening all my tabs here so we can go on
this
with the
definitely,
show.
Definitely an IRC chore here.
Yes. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was 76. In any event, though, moving on from the Star Wars story, unless, Bill, do you want to weigh in on what if the Empire had access to big data before we move on?
I mean, not really. It just, you think back to, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years, God, 40 years ago, I'm getting old. You know, that time, privacy really has shaped our lives very differently. You know, everything is now available. There are very, very few personal attributes that aren't somewhere online, whereas we just didn't have those concerns. It's kind of it's a very interesting article to put our lives today into the perspective of something that happened so long ago.
Right. 77, I'm being told from the studio. I had my travel dates wrong. All right, Evan, speaking of traveling around the web, there was an interesting case in New York that involved sharing browsing information with Facebook. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. This was a case that came up under the Video Privacy Protection Act. I forget the name of the case. Was it Austin versus American, like the AMC.com website was, or the AMC, the AMC website, the TV network's website was at issue here. And it was a case brought under the Video Privacy Protection Act, which is that statute from 1988, 11 years after Star Wars, that says that it's unlawful for a like a video store, for example, to disclose the titles of movies, VHS tapes, you know, that you would go rent, that a customer would rent. And this happened, you can't talk about the VPPA, the Video Privacy Protection Act, without talking about its historical context in which it arose. That was right after the confirmation hearings for Judge Bork, who, if, for those of you who haven't heard his name, that's because he was not he was nominated, but he was not what's the word? Confirmed. To be, yeah, to be a Supreme Court justice. And part of it was because of these salacious movie titles that a reporter had dug up that he had rented from his local video store. So politicians thought, oh my gosh, we're all subject to this. So we've got to pass a statute here that protects our privacy. So that's the whole context of it. And what was going on here was that the AMC website was using Facebook Connect. And so a user, if they were logged into Facebook and even had closed the browser and opened it backed up, if you had clicked the, you know, remember me button or whatever it's called on Facebook, you know, the cookie was still active on that user's device. And so when they would go to the AMC website and watch trailers of videos on there, that information was being transmitted back to Facebook. And so there was a class action lawsuit, and it got dismissed at the 12B6 stage, which is relatively early in the lawsuit, a motion to dismiss, just, you know, looking at the complaint that was filed, because there's no legal, you know, it doesn't, it fails as a matter of law. The judge threw it out in this situation because the complaint didn't allege enough facts to say that the casual website user was a subscriber. And that is a term that's in the VPPA. You know, this protects consumers. And, you know, one form of consumer of video content is a subscriber. And so the connection with just a casual visitor going to a website and watching videos was too tenuous. The relationship wasn't durable enough, was one of the words the court used to say that there's this relationship between the end user and the website for it to be considered a subscriber. So the result of that is that there's, or as of right now, no lawsuit going on for violation of the VPPA against the AMC website for having that information about what was being used disclosed to Facebook because of this cookie that was on the user's machine. So a pretty wonky, pretty nuanced part of the act there, but it just goes to show how you know, the whole integration of platforms and, you know, especially social media platforms and social media platforms like Facebook, who love to be very, very grabby about getting information, really presents some new challenges under old statutory frameworks like the VPPA. And I guess I should say, I wrote about this case on internetcases.com. And then about a week before that, there was another case involving Hulu. Under the VPPA, and the holding there was a little bit different. It was about whether or not there had actually been a disclosure to Facebook, because in that situation, it was a little bit further along in the lawsuit. It was a motion for summary judgment, and the motion for summary judgment was granted because there wasn't enough evidence to show that even though Facebook had this information about what people were using, what videos they were watching, there was no information that they had actually, that Facebook had actually connected disparate pieces of data to draw a conclusion about who is actually watching a particular piece of content. So there's a lot of activity lately, the past few months under the Video Privacy Protection Act, which is an interesting little gem of a statute that we have from different time periods being applied to a new and modern novel contexts.
Yeah, it seems like you point out that it is an older statute that it seems like people are taking creative stabs at applying it to new situations and just sort of seeing how that goes. Because certainly people are concerned, not just if they have designs on the Supreme Court, but in their day-to-day lives. about their information being shared with Facebook, who I guess is the evil empire in this scenario, gobbling up all the data it can, looking for ways to address that if it's happening, you know, in a way that they don't think they've agreed to or bought into. I wanted to ask you, Evan, if you think Do Not Track plays into this at all. I suppose if Do Not Track had been on the person's browser and a cookie was placed nonetheless, then it could be a different analysis for the court.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly how that would come out. I think, you know, certainly there's going to be inferences to be drawn from what that user intended for his or her information, how that information could be used if they turned on the Do Not Track feature. But at the same time, I don't know that that would have changed the analysis under the statute, because what, at least in this AMC case, what was relevant was, you know, how much of a relationship there was between the user and that website, and whether you have Do Not Track on or off doesn't make that relationship any different. So I'm not sure the outcome would have been different, but, you know, maybe in a larger evaluation of this kind of situation, if you have Do Not Track turned on, it demonstrates what that person's stated expectations are and could go toward, you know, helping in a larger, broader analysis of what that person's expectation of, you know, how their information was going to be used in the appropriate context. So I do think those issues are related. I don't know if it would have been dispositive, but definitely sort of come from the same desire of the person to stay private.
Bill, what does the marketer in you think of applying the Video Privacy Protection Act to browsing and video viewing habits and the sharing of the resulting data with things like Facebook?
I'm not familiar enough with the act to really opine on that one, Denise.
Right. No, I wasn't asking for a legal opinion. I was just thinking that it might even, to a layperson, strike as, you know, as Evan was pointing out, this is an act that was designed to do one thing that's now being applied in other contexts, and the courts are sort of feeling their way through that. And I'm guessing the marketers in general would be skeptical about that application.
I would think so as well. I mean, marketers tend to be pretty optimistic and think about, you know, what are the future applications and how are we going to monetize those, which is, you know, how I look at it as well.
Right. Sarah, any thoughts on this?
Well, to me, it kind of shows how deficient our privacy laws are that we have to keep going back to this this very outdated act and kind of stretching it to try to make it work in these different contexts. So it's kind of interesting in that respect.
So do you think that we need more of I hate to put you on the spot and say, so we need more federal privacy legislation then, but I guess that's what I'm asking you. Do we need something that's specifically targeted at websites sharing data among themselves that users technically may be on notice of, because the fact that the data is being shared is buried in some terms of service somewhere that no one has read?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, I certainly don't know what that should look like, and it's incredibly complicated. But I think in general, as a policy matter, putting the onus on the individual and claiming that they have notice and that is sufficient to protect privacy, I just think is woefully inadequate, because even people that care don't know how to find out the right information and also just don't feel like they have other options. I feel like it needs to be looked at collectively rather than by the individual.
Yep, I see what you're saying there. Let us thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. And again, wonderful Mother's Day sponsor here. We've got Pro Flowers for you guys to take a look at. Mother's Day is coming up on Sunday, May 10th, if I haven't mentioned that yet already. It will be here before you know it. Now is the time to get on it and make sure that you've appreciated the mothers in your life. Appreciating your mom and other mothers in your life, this Mother's Day doesn't have to be stressful, because Pro Flowers makes buying a beautiful gift for your mom simple and quick. They've got everything you need for Mother's Day and for all the moms in your life. You choose the delivery date you want, and it's guaranteed. And best of all, their flowers are guaranteed to be fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days after you receive them. And don't think that you are limited to flowers by any means. They do some wonderful things where they blend flowers with delectable strawberries or candy, and plants. They have really gorgeous bonsais and blooming plants. I mentioned when we mentioned Pro Flowers last week that I went ahead and purchased a gardenia for my mom for Mother's Day from Pro Flowers because it's a beautiful flowering plant. And if you've never experienced a gardenia, they're one of the sweetest smelling flowers that are available. So that's available there. There are beautiful succulents available, which is great in California, in our drought-ridden state. They have things that you don't have to water that frequently in order for them to continue to be beautiful. I really like, they have a heart succulent wreath that is quite lovely. Other succulents that are available. And the website's just a breeze to use. You can, if you have a particular flower that you like, it's real easy to find that. If you need just Mother's Day ideas, they have great things teed up for you. I really like, too, that they have some more non-traditional floral arrangements available for you. I loved that they had an air plant in a glass bowl that hung from a macrame hanger you could hang from the ceiling or a window or something. Again, you know, the 70s flower child in me from California just loved that little item. And there is something for exactly what your taste and your mom's taste too. The website is spectacular to use, wide range of beautiful flowers, and they start at just $19.99 plus shipping. There are flowers there for all occasions, not just Mother's Day, including roses, daisies, tulips, orchids, lilies, and more. And every order comes with the Pro Flowers guarantee. So for Mother's Day, Pro Flowers has a special offer for fans of Twit. You can get one dozen rainbow roses in a free glass vase for only $19.99 plus shipping. Or you can upgrade to two dozen roses in a free glass vase for just $9.99 more. Visit proflowers.com today, click the blue microphone in the top right corner, and be sure to enter the code TWIT. But you only have until Friday, May 8th to take advantage of this special offer. And if you order by then, you can still get guaranteed delivery for Mother's Day. That's proflowers.com and use the code TWIT, T-W-I-T. Thank you so much, ProFlowers, for your support. And on behalf of TWIT, to all mothers out there, happy Mother's Day. All right, I think we will move into the journalism realm for a bit, since we're blessed at having Bill on the show with us today, who's working in that realm.
Ooh, this is a new one.
Yes, San provided us with a few more bumpers since your departure. That's what was new. You asked me what was new since you had not been on the show. We have a few more bumpers now. Yay. Actually, I think we have bumpers for all our topics now. Thank you, Sando. Did a really beautiful job on those for us. San, too, is just, he's been just an intern extraordinaire. We've been so excited to have him involved in the show. He's a huge, huge help. So thank you. Let's talk a bit about Scoop with Bill. Bill, I know we featured your site as a resource of the week. Tell us once again why it's something that reporters should pay attention to.
Sure, Denise. Scoop is a site that helps reporters gather information from public data sites like the SEC and the Patent Office and the federal court system. And the reason that's important is because business reporters spend almost a day per week digging around for company information in these sites. And so by aggregating this information and allowing reporters to establish alerts so that every time there's a new filing or a court case, for example, Scoop will trigger an alert. By doing this, we're saving them all kinds of time that they can then turn around and use to generate more original content, which is really the important part right now. Everybody thinks that journalism is dying, that with the newspapers are dying and so forth. But the truth is that over the past 2 years, there has been a net increase in hiring of reporters. And that's because there's been a huge amount of investment poured into the news media space, $850 million, in fact, over the past couple of years. And that's because certain outlets have figured out what the new, next printing press is, and that's called social media. So sites like Business Insider and Vox and First Look and Recode and a bunch of others have figured out how to monetize via social media. And so now there's this gold rush for original content. And so what's happening today are these outlets are throwing that money at more reporters, which is great. But nobody has looked at yet, what are the technology tools that can help make those reporters more efficient? And by the way, it's not like reporters love digging around and doing that kind of research in arcane places like the patent office and the SEC. So this frees them up to do what they really love to do, which is write and break interesting stories.
Right. And it's not just reporters. It's lawyers, it's bloggers. Yep. And we can talk about how we've evolved into a world where it's very hard to make a line distinction between who's a journalist and who's not as people get ready to sit ringside at the fight tomorrow. I think there was a huge need for someone to try and make sense and a more convenient and accessible way to access public records that are available from disparate sources now. I thought it'd be fun to pick your brain as the founder of a startup, Bill, on some of the legal considerations that have gone into putting Scoop together. And one of them would be, you know, you've built a better mousetrap here as far as aggregating these sources. Can you tell us about the process that went into that?
Sure. So, I mean, from a legal perspective, there's the formation issues, of course. Then there's the intellectual property concerns. And as we talked about earlier, we're not too concerned about what we're doing now because all the information is publicly available. And Scoop isn't the only one that is using information from the SEC. Morningstar, Bloomberg, they're all doing interesting things with and analyzing SEC documents and other company types of activity. LexisNexis has built a huge empire on doing the same thing with court records. And there's other sites like Inography, which is kind of new. They do the same thing with patents and so forth. So what Scoop has done is just done, we've created a lightweight version of all of those sites and put it under one roof and made it easier for journalist access. And as you pointed out, Denise, lawyers are using it. We have wealth managers, currency managers, IP portfolio managers using it. You know, my background is PR and journalism, so that's the problem area that we're focused on. But we're also very interested in understanding how other people, lawyers maybe who don't want to pay the freight for, you know, or for LexisNexis, et cetera, are using. So we're very interested in the use cases there.
All right. Evan, do you want to ask any questions or find out more about Scoop?
Yeah. I mean, it's, well, first of all, is it open just to journalists or what's the current market on it right now? Cause I heard you talk about expanding, you know, plans there. What's sort of, where is it and where is it going?
Right now, Evan, it's mostly journalists on board. I would say 95%, just because that's where we're marketing right now. But we are open to other markets as well, and then we can figure out what to do once we see how the customers are using it.
Uh-huh. And then I guess the other thing I would be most curious about, and I'm certainly not asking you to disclose any kind of trade secrets or anything you want to keep confidential, because I imagine there's some pretty intense special sauce here. But what can you tell us about the technology to do this? What kind of algorithms do you use? How do you, what can you say about, you know, how you determine relevance? What kind of considerations go into that, you know, so that there actually are good filters here? I was reminded of, what Clay Shirky said a few years ago. It's not that we have information overload. It's just that we have filter failure. That's what, you know, that your service sort of triggered that. This is overcoming filter failure, really, because we've got all this information. Mm-hmm. How do we make it useful?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's a wonderful quote. So the technology is really search technology. My co-founder has spent his entire career in search and data extraction. And actually, I came from search right before founding Scoop. I was director of PR at Bing for Microsoft. And so what we do, and it's different technology, different search technology that we apply to each data source, because the SEC publishes its information differently than the patent office and different from the 164 federal courts that we track. But essentially, we gather the information using the search technology, put it in our own database so that we can then make some sense of it in terms of serving it back to the journalists. Now, we do a couple of interesting things today that that even the our data sources don't do. So, for example, in the SEC, if a company's insider or executive sells stock or gets a stock grant or something like that, the company issues what's known as a Form 4 for those not in the know. And it's a table-looking document that has a bunch of codes in it and a bunch of numbers. And so what Scoop does is we actually do the accounting on that form, so that if you did a search for Google and you saw a Form 4 for Sergey Brin, we would total it up and say that, you know, Sergey sold another $18 million worth of stock under his 10b5-1 plan. And that's something that that the SEC doesn't do. And so we're adding some value as well. Now, you raised the point about relevance, and relevance is very important, and it's something that we're going to apply more and more as we get more data on board. So, for example, if somebody does a search for Apple, well, that could yield all sorts of results. There's Apple, the manufacturer of Macs and Apple Watches. There's Apple juice producers, and now that we're tracking federal courts, there are a number of personal bankruptcy cases that are coming up. So we're using relevance science essentially to surface the type of information we think that our audience is actually looking for, which is typically something about Apple Inc. And so we'll make that suggestion to you. But over time, we'll get even better and better at that. So using the Form 4 example, if somebody did a search for Google, or better, think of alerts. We wouldn't trigger alerts for a little 1,000-share transaction, because we would understand that journalists really don't care that much about it. Now, when Sergey Brin sells an unusual amount of stock, then that's something that is could be more relevant, and so we would surface that information to our journalists.
So I'm curious, right now you're dealing strictly with public record sources. Do you plan to open up into other things? You mentioned LinkedIn earlier. Is LinkedIn the new PR newswire?
LinkedIn is not the new PR newswire. The new PR newswire is an interesting separate conversation. But LinkedIn is highly relevant for reporters, because it's an indication as to what type of hiring is going on in the company, who's made executive moves, and so forth. Twitter is another example. Reporters think of that as the modern-day police scanner. But the problem with the police scanner, of course, is you get up to go to the bathroom or grab lunch, and you miss the call for the four-alarm fire. And so what we hope to do over time is to be able to aggregate the certain signals from social media, whether it's Twitter or LinkedIn or Quora, and to be able to use Evan's words, apply relevance so that reporters can then we can give the right information to reporters. Like, hey, you know, there not only was there a four alarm fire, but here's what people are saying about it. And or if there's an important executive from a company who makes a tweet that is later followed up and creates this conversation, we want to make sure that we're surfacing that that type of information. So yes. We do have plenty of plans to increase the number of data sources that we're aggregating beyond the what I think of as the low-hanging fruit of public data.
Right. That could raise some interesting things that you might have to iron out, not just using Twitter's API, since Twitter information is by definition ephemeral and only certain outlets are authorized to archive it. In any way. So that's something that could come up for you down the line.
Yeah.
It's something that kind of relates in a way to our next story too, which is the newsworthiness of an event, a story, a piece of media that might also be independently monetizable as well. And what I'm referring to in this case has to do with the Walter Scott shooting and the cell phone video of that shooting. The New York Times recently reported that a celebrity and publicity management company called Marks and Sparks was going to news outlets and attempting to charge them up to $10,000 for using that video in their coverage. And various other sites reported that Marks and Clarks had put the opinion out in the New York Times saying at some point it's not newsworthy anymore. You're using it for commercial benefit, so you should have to pay us, basically, is what they say. We're representing the rights holder, I guess, is their standpoint. And unfortunately, or fortunately, some copyright scholars, including Christopher Sprigman and James Grimmelman and others, have had the chance to weigh in on this and basically said, wait a minute, fair use is fair use, and newsworthiness lasts a little longer than perhaps you're thinking about. Sarah, have you looked this over, and do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, I do. I think it's really interesting, and I always love when Chris Sprigman gets interviewed because he always has colorful quotes. But yes, this idea that newsworthiness ends right at the moment was a new one. So that's clearly silly. I think the case is still, or not the case, this incident is interesting from a fair use perspective, though, just because these sorts of things are going to happen more and more as people have cameras on their phones and are recording everything all of the time, and you don't know when something's going to end up being newsworthy. So this idea that someone could then prevent or charge basically royalties to news organizations who then use these images or these videos is really interesting and seems like it could set a bad precedent. I don't know that it's completely clear cut, though. Based on prior cases, there's the those Los Angeles News Service cases. There are a series of them, which I can never keep track of which one is which in my head, but where they had helicopter video of, I think it was another police beating in that situation. And they sued a bunch of different news outlets for copyright infringement, and they won some and lost some. So I think it's not just the case that if it's newsworthy, then you can use it. It's not quite that simple. But it's also not so simple that newsworthiness ends the moment the event's over. So it's a little bit more complicated.
Right. I think you're thinking of maybe the Reginald Denny, Rodney King, all that stuff. Yes, yep. There was litigation about all that way back in the day. Evan, what do you think about this?
You know, this is really tough. This is probably one of the tougher, well, all of fair use is tough. And I'd say this is in particular one of the tougher parts of fair use, because you have to read Section 107 very carefully, because we know what fair use is, and we feel it intuitively, and we sort of have that idea of, you know, those four fair use factors. But if you actually read Section 107 very carefully, what Section 107 does not say is just because a piece of content is newsworthy, ergo it's fair use. What Section 107 does say is that fair use is not an infringement, and it says fair use, you know, fair use of content for purposes such as news gathering, making a newsworthy purpose or executing a newsworthy purpose is not an infringement. So you see the distinction I'm drawing. So just because it's newsworthy does not mean it's fair use. And I'm wondering if that, and of course, James Grimmelman I'm sorry, the other professor's name. I know that we know him.
Who was it? Christopher Sprigman.
Yeah, Christopher Sprigman. Sorry.
AKA Left Shark's lawyer.
Oh yeah. That's right. Has he been on the show? Did we talk to him once?
He has.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
I think he's been on several times.
Yeah, so I'm sorry about blanking on that. But, you know, guys know everything there is to know about copyright. But I just wonder if a little bit, maybe unconsciously, we're sort of glossing over this idea that newsworthiness does not always equal fair use. It's can be a big indicator of it. And so I'm not so quick to say, oh my gosh, it's ridiculous to say that the Walter Scott video is not fair use. I think there actually could be a market for content like this. One of the things that Christopher Sprigman, said, was that people don't buy iPhones or mobile devices, I'm paraphrasing what he said and taking liberties with it, they don't buy it so they can go film the police. That's probably true. But I, with the Walter Scott video in particular, I heard in the media that the person who filmed this actually hesitated for a while before turning it over to the authorities, or actually they turned it over to Walter Scott's family first, I guess. Because you know, it obviously was going to unleash a great torrent of activity here. They thought about deleting it. So I think at that decision point, there could really be a copyright incentive saying, you know, if you're on the fence of saying whether to turn it over for the sense of justice and well-being because of, you know, you're doing the right thing versus living in obscurity, the fact that you think you might make a little bit of money off of this actually could have an incentive, which would be in the public interest. So I would caution us to be quick and to be careful and deliberate about saying just because it's newsworthy, it's fair use, and discounting the fact that there actually could be a copyright utilitarian incentive in situations like this that ought to militate against a finding of fair use, because if it's fair use, then the copyright owner can't monetize it. If the copyright owner can't monetize it, there's not that incentive. So we've just got to be careful about this debate, just that as with all of them, we can't be too knee-jerky in these things.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Evan, and it's not something that came immediately to my mind on reading this, so thank you for that. We're getting to the point where I want to give you our resources and tip of the week. We have one final patent story that's almost a resource in itself. So let's do that and we'll roll into the next resources. And the patent story in question, the reason it's a resource is because Google made an announcement this week that's pretty interesting. They are opening up a forum, an exchange, where it's called the Patent Purchase Promotion. And it's an experimental marketplace where they're going to buy your patent if you're in the market to sell your patent. The point of doing so is to... obviously, for Google to obtain more patents is one of the points, but they've teed it up on their public policy blog as, we'd rather see the patents stay away from patent trolls. They say patent owners sell patents for numerous reasons, such as the need to raise money or changes in a company's business direction. Unfortunately, the usual patent marketplace can sometimes be challenging, especially for smaller participants who sometimes end up working with patent trolls. So, you know, much as you can be a skeptic and say this is Google's way of just, you know, putting themselves out there as someone else who will buy your patent and maybe just a good marketing move, there's nothing to say that Google wouldn't have bought your patent without the patent purchase promotion, or wouldn't buy it after the patent purchase promotion ends. It is a limited experiment they're doing. It's going to last from Friday, May 8th through May 22nd, when they're going to have a streamlined portal open for patent holders to tell Google about the patents they're willing to sell at a price that they set. And then they'll have some discussion and they'll see if they want to buy your patent. So it's just an interesting way to go about it. It certainly is Google taking a stance against patent trolls and trying to keep patents out of their hands. I like this comment from Alan Lowe, who posted this. He's their deputy general counsel for patents. He says, think of it as a 20% project for Google's patent lawyers. So they're just floating it out there and seeing how it works. Evan, do you think this is a good idea? Or are you a little skeptical? What's your take?
Well, you know, I don't know enough about it really to be definitive on it. I mean, there's plenty to be skeptical about if you want to think about it, you know, because there's an awful lot of patents out there. And if Google is going to effectively keep all the patents out of the hands of the trolls, it would be buying a bunch of, you know, millions of, well, I don't know if it's millions, you know, not millions, but, you know, many, many, many patents, much more than what it would buy in this little window of time here. So that makes me a little bit skeptical that there are other motives here than motives other than just trying to do the right thing for the world in relation to patent trolls. They might be just trying to get it's Google after all, so they're trying to get information about this. So I'm sure they'll draw conclusions, make analyses on the types of technology that are offered up to them in this window. So there's plenty to be gained by Google in addition to the patents that it actually decides to purchase during this limited window here. So I think that that might be the sort of another collateral asset. I don't want to say that because that has a different connotation when you're talking about assets. It's not like a security interest, but you know what I mean? There's this ancillary type of information that they'll be getting in all of this transaction. So that makes me think that there's more than one motive. There's several different things going on here, I would imagine.
Right. And Ben Lowe over at The Verge points out that Google doesn't, Ben Popper. Lowe is the last name of the patent attorney I just mentioned at Google. Anyway, makes the point that Google hasn't promised not to use these patents for litigation, although they have made some assurances like that in the past. And the program does not try to open the marketplace to other tech companies to participate in, which might be a good idea too. So it will be interesting to see how it goes. And if you have a patent for sale, you might want to explore this. Any thoughts on this, Sarah, before we move on?
Yeah, well, just to kind of latch onto that last thing you said, I was really surprised that they didn't have a pledge not to use the patents or, you know, thinking about using a defensive patent license. There are definitely patent pools and a lot of existing ways to go that they could have, existing mechanisms to kind of make that promise more explicit. And so it is surprising to me that they didn't go that route. It does kind of make you wonder what the motives are. And it also does seem to me like this is clearly just a Band-Aid strategy. It can't be our long-term, you know, solution to the patent troll problem. And in some ways, if they did continue it, it seems like it just kind of further creates the incentive to go after these kind of silly patents that cover different things that Google, you know, because you can possibly sell it to Google in addition to patent trolls. So it kind of just expands the market for patents. So it seems like it's in some ways creates the wrong incentive. But
right. It'd be fun to get Alan Lowe on the show and see if we could get some of those questions answered. So maybe we'll invite him and see what happens.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Those are good points. Let's move on to our tip and resource of the week. Our tip of the week is in our ongoing series of Creative Commons license tips. Sarah, this week we've talked a lot about the licenses and how you can search for things, how you can apply them, why you would use them. I just thought with your exposure to and working with Creative Commons on a regular basis and the works that people have applied the licenses to, if you might have a list of all stars that you have in mind, things that you're just delighted to see available under a Creative Commons license.
Yeah, this was a fun one. Thanks for asking, because I went ahead and kind of asked the rest of our staff to throw me ideas and so I learned some fun ones. So I picked three that I thought were, and they're really different. So the first is the electric slide is apparently under a Creative Commons non-commercial license. That one was, all of these were actually new to me. I thought was interesting. So leaving aside the
of the electric slide, it's a dance, right?
Right. It's a dance. So I was going to say, leaving aside the question of whether or not you could really copyright the dance and that whole issue, I just think it's kind of
that's right in the Copyright Act. That's one of the things that's specially called out, right? Choreographs, along with like mimes, stuff that mimes do. Isn't that right in the? I'm going to look that up while you continue talking.
Yeah, you look it up because I don't know off the top of my head. But apparently, someone who claimed to own it had sued someone, and there was a settlement, and part of the settlement was for them to agree to apply a Creative Commons license to it. Was fascinating. Another is this film, and this one I guess I had heard of, called Orang Yu, which is about an orangutan that's going to college, and it's being created by one of our developers on our staff, and it's on Indiegogo right now, and it's going to be, it promises to be hilarious, I'm sure. It's a legit movie. They've got an IMDb credit and everything. The last one was that the data to print models of Tom York's head is available. And so you can actually print 3D models. This came from after Radiohead distributed data from one of its music videos under a CC license. And that was kind of one of the weird, quirky uses that came out of it. So those were three that I thought were kind of fun and surprising.
Those are great. Thank you so much, Sarah. I hope folks will check those out. Our resource for you is by Carrie O'Shea Gorgone, if I'm saying her name properly. She writes something called... Well, she writes it at her own site, carriegorgone.com, and her tagline is "What Marketers Need to Know Legally Speaking." And she has a great post on Meerkat, Periscope, privacy, and the law, and the legalities of live streaming video. She goes into how you can do a quick analysis to sort of troubleshoot whether something you're hoping to live stream might be protected under somebody's copyright that could get you into trouble. She discusses the private place versus public place distinction and things that you might get into regarding people objecting to your streaming depending on where you are. She also talks about people's rights of publicity and how that can be a concern for you. So if you are someone who wants to live stream chunks of your life, either for pleasure or profit or both, I encourage you to check out this article because she doesn't really answer, you know, how you can address all these concerns, but she at least tells you what you should be looking for and keeping an eye out for so that you're not blindsided by the legal issues that can come your way because there are a host of them.
Hey, speaking of live stream, do you remember Jenny Cam back in like 1999, 2000?
I do. Yeah.
There was an article in Ars Technica recently about that whole situation, how she was, I think they called her like social media patient zero or something like this. Because this was like, she set up I'm totally going off topic here, but just picking up on the live streaming thing and just how she has now faded into obscurity. She married somebody with the last name of Johnson. So now her name is Jennifer Johnson. So she's totally ungoogleable because of the obscurity of the commonness of her first name. Okay. So it's just, I was just bringing that up, wondering if you remember that, because that goes way back into the days when people were listening to, you know, using Real Player to listen to music.
That's what I was going to say. I'm sure she's off somewhere watching Real Media Video. Not to pick on you, Bill. We're wrapping up the show, but that is a real issue that we talk about a lot on the show is the durability of media and the fact that a good deal of creative work and newsworthy and historical material is, for better or worse, and probably unavoidable, becoming locked up in digital formats that may not be the most popular one of the day for very long. I'm just wondering if you have any particular insights on that for us.
Well, you know, it's like we talked about before. It's the you know, the modern day, you know, 8-track tape. And, you know, my wife and I, we're always talking about, you know, taking old tapes and transferring them into the latest media and then like archiving them somewhere so we can use them later. But the truth is, whatever it is that we transfer the data into, whatever format, who's to say that that's not going to be obscure tomorrow? Right. So really, I mean, the opportunity there is to create that continuum of you know, transferability.
Ooh, I like that. Continuum of transferability. That's something we should aspire to in our media consumption and creation. All right. This has been a really fun show. I really appreciate Bill Hankis for joining us. I got to tell you, Bill, I'm so sad, but every time I've thought of your name while prepping for the show this week, I keep having references to South Park pop into my mind. So I'm gonna banish them right now.
You are not going there.
Bill Hankis, so glad you could join us. Scoop is a great product. Anything that makes public records, particularly public access legal records, more searchable, more surfaceable is a wonderful thing, and we're glad you're doing it.
thanks very much, and thanks for having me on the show.
Is there anything coming up, anything you want to let people know, things you'll be speaking at, things you want people to pay attention to in the near future before we sign off?
June 3rd or 4th, I'm speaking at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference in Philadelphia, so I'm looking forward to that. And other than that, we'll have regular product updates on Scoop.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Sarah, great to see you as always.
Thank you so much. Great to see you. Great to be here.
And Evan, I cannot thank you enough. You know, we had our 300th show last week and scheduling just didn't work to have you back for that. But we're going to have our 9th anniversary as a show in October. It would be great if we can pencil you in to come for that one.
For sure. I would love that. I would love that. And I'll be happy to come on episode 400 as well, because I know we'll be going strong then. So, yeah.
This has
really been a blast. Thank you so much for having me back. It's like I said, I don't know if we were on, you know, film taping yet before I said, I feel like I'm right back at home. So thank you for your hospitality and for the wonderful conversation. Sarah, great to talk with you. Keep up the good work here. Bill, really nice to meet you. Enjoyed hearing about you and your background and your current things going on there with Scoop. Sounds like really interesting stuff. So I've really appreciated the chance to be here.
We've really appreciated the chance to have this discussion with all of you, and really appreciated the audience that's joined us during the show. If you have done so, that means you've tuned in at twit.tv at 11 a.m. Pacific time and 1800 UTC. I don't think it's dark outside right now. That's when we do the show live each week. But don't worry about it. If you can't make the show live, we are available for you after the fact and on demand. If you go to twit.tv/twill, our entire archive of shows is there. We also have a YouTube channel. If that works better for you, various ways of subscribing to the show are laid out at our twit.tv site. So we're just happy, however you can join us. Thrilled to have you along for the ride each week as we explore these complicated and fun and interesting and relevant issues at the intersection of technology and law. You can get in touch with Sarah and I between the shows. I am Denise at twit.tv. Sarah is Sarah P at twit.tv. Great way to let us know guests you think we should have on, topics you think we should address, further discussion or insights you have to add to things we've already talked about. We love hearing from you. We really couldn't do the show without you. So please keep your thoughts and suggestions and comments coming. We really need that. Remember, you can see the entire discussion point list for all of our shows at our Delicious page, which is delicious.com/thisweekinlaw. This was episode 301. So /301 will put you into all the things we discussed today. And we'll be back next week for our next episode of This Week in Law. Thanks so much. Take care.
Right on.
There we go. I've missed that right on, Evan.
Yeah.